Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And UnitedHealthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Welcome to the Football Writers Podcast, featuring me, Mike Calvin, Paul Haywood, the columnist and author, and Glenn Moore of World Soccer. The World Cup finals in Qatar kick off in precisely 63 weeks. According to that much-derided countdown clock in the England coach's room at St George's Park, it's meant to mark England's coming of age as a world force. There's no doubt they'll qualify, irrespective of what happens in Poland on Wednesday. Gareth Southgate has called on his squad to build on the advances made in the European Championships. Italy are breaking records. Germany are getting into gear under Hansi Flick. Heaven knows what will emerge from the chaos involving Brazil and Argentina, but the South American challenge will be as viable as ever. What about England, Paul? Viable candidates as well?
Oh, definitely, Mike. Semi-finals of the last World Cup, finalists at Euro 2020, a lot of talented young players who are bound to improve, depth in the squad, togetherness, spirit, a manager who's really in command of his brief. And I'm impressed by the way they came out of Euro 2020. They've come out undaunted, refreshed. They seem to want to get back on with the job, show how good they are. And, you know, on the form book alone, Mike, as I said, semi-finalist and finalist in consecutive tournaments, that makes them very high in the market for a Winter World Cup, which should suit English players potentially, although we don't know about the conditions in Qatar. They could be anything, frankly. But as ever, you know, you've got to guard against English insularity and acknowledge the progress made by other countries. And you've mentioned already Germany and Italy, and you could also point to, you know, countries like Spain, Denmark were going the right way. So it's not just about how good you are at World Cups, it's about the threats you face. But as things stand, England are in seriously good nick.
Mm. We'll dwell on the wider issues, you know, like racism, a little later, Glenn. But how significant do you think was the nature of that England win in Hungary? It seemed measured and it was a quietly defiant performance. And is that a sign of increasing maturity, do you think?
Yes, I think it is. Because, I mean, although we'll look back at that and think, oh, that was an easy win. And obviously Hungary have just lost to Albania, which sort of confirms it. I mean, Hungary during the Euros at home gave France and Portugal, you know, tough games and it, away in Germany. I mean, so it did look in advance like a very daunting match. It's only a tricky match to negotiate. And yet when you go there and you win comfortably, completely in control of the game, one of those games where, you know, the goals often come a little bit later, because, but it's partly because you've worn out the opposition. You've moved them around. You know, you gradually drain them mentally and physically. So you do get, doesn't mean, you know, because you're playing well, quite often in those games, the goals will come at a late rush. And you've earned that over the way you played in the first 45 minutes, first hour or so. Yeah, it looked very impressive, very mature, even without taking into account the other circumstances, just in terms of a pure football sense. You know, we're completely in control of the game and looked dangerous going forwards.
And, you know, we look at games against Andorra. Well, basically, we approach them with a sign usually, don't we? The formalities of the World Cup qualifying programme are almost completed before they began. You know, Wednesday's game in Poland is pretty much the only remotely testing fixture left. Paul, does this beg the question, does the World Cup qualifying system require revision, you know, probably through reduction?
Probably, Mike. Every time you watch a game, an Andorra game, you wonder what the point of it is. And at the same time, you kind of rally to the great democracy of, you know, equal opportunities. Every country should have an equal chance to go to the World Cup, no matter how small. But you do end up with these sprawling qualifying rounds, which obviously in this day and age, when everybody's scrapping for a spare minute in the calendar, start to attract attention. I tend to want to defend international football in general against the kind of encroachments of the club game. And although these qualifying processes do look sprawling and unwieldy and sometimes pointless, they do serve a purpose. And, you know, for the good teams, there is development, there is progression, there is a chance for players to bed themselves in ahead of tournaments. So some of the benefits, I think, aren't obvious at the time, but you do see them when the tournaments come round. And England are an example of that, because Gareth Southgate twice now has prepared England for tournaments extremely well.
The other thing is, just to come in on that, I mean, you could argue that UEFA are one of the very few confederations where everybody's involved. I mean, CONCACAF, Asia, Africa, they all have some form of seeding. Oceania haven't decided this year's format. So it wouldn't be unusual to drop a lot of teams out. But when you look, I'd only really get rid of the real minnows that have some kind of pre-qualifying, the Gibraltars and San Marinos. If you look at the progress of Albania and Northern Ireland, Wales, North Macedonia, obviously comes against playing against better teams. And if you look at the current qualifying process, I mean, from where we're standing, it looks very straightforward. But Portugal, Spain, the Netherlands, none of those are gimmies where they're standing in the groups at the moment. Italy are breaking records, but they're drawing games. They're also up against a bit with the Swiss. Only the top team get an automatic qualification. So it's by no means guaranteed that, you know, it's not that easy for some of these teams. You do have to still win these games, which England are doing.
What about the theory, Paul, that when you play against players of a lower level, you know, they're simply not good enough, they're not quick enough to actually almost secure your own safety, you know, a mistimed lunge, you've got a player going to get injured. Does that sort of criticism or observation hold any weight with you?
Well, when you look at it, intuitively you think, oh God, you know, that £10 million England player's just been upended by a guy who works in a bank, and it doesn't look too clever. But I think if you broke it down, I think there'd be very few cases of a player being seriously injured by a minnow in a qualifying game. I'm struggling to think of an example of a player, you know, being put out for 6 months by one of those tackles. So it's potentially a problem, but in fact, I don't recall it being a particularly big issue. In the end, the star players get back up.
Yeah, I mean, one of the worst tackles we've seen this qualifying round was Koundé, who's like rated very, very highly. Chelsea nearly bought him on Kolasinac. Yeah, and that's the top player.
Yeah. Yeah. In terms of the players who benefited from that Andorra game, you're looking probably, Glenn, at Bellingham, Jesse Lingard, perhaps. Who didn't take their chance?
Well, I guess it's difficult for Patrick Bamford because he didn't get a lot of service in the first half. So, I mean, you'd assume, oh, great, Andorra at home. What more can you ask for as a centre forward in your first game? But you still have to get the service. I guess you could say Southgate benefited from seeing the Trent Alexander-Arnold experiment in midfield probably didn't work. Rhys James has played a lot more there, was more successful there. I can see the temptation. If you remember, obviously, Philip Lahm became an extremely successful midfielder, having converted from fullback. But it's not as easy as some people might think. I mean, they've tried it in the women's game with Lucy Bronze, and it's not really worked playing her midfield. And I guess it's a different... Suddenly you get players around you rather than the game is always in front of you at fullback. And your options are slightly more diminished by the fact that you can't kick it on one side because the ball would be going off. So I guess Southgate's probably learned that isn't a way to try and shoehorn two very good players into the team. And it won't have done Alexander-Arnold any drawbacks, because obviously we know he's a fantastic right-back. But in terms of elsewhere, I mean, you don't get much to do in goal in those games, but it's nice to get time on the pitch. Yeah, so in the back four, you haven't got an awful lot to do in those games.
What about, we can't avoid the political dimension to anything to do with the World Cup, Paul. FIFA are pushing really hard for a two-year cycle, which is something, inevitably, I suppose, that UEFA are opposing. Are we in a familiar situation here where football is once again bedeviled by political and financial self-interest?
Well, it's amusing to see Arsene Wenger being at the forefront of a, you know, a sort of fact-finding
mission.
The great idealist, eh?
Potentially pushing for a World Cup every 2 years, which I've never met anybody who wants to see the World Cup every 2 years. I mean, the Ryder Cup mainly, but not the World Cup. It would create chaos. It would fixture chaos. It would remove the magic of the World Cup by turning it into a kind of routine event, if you like. Its only purpose could be, increase the wealth and reach of FIFA at a time when it's losing out pretty heavily in many ways to UEFA, the Champions League, and the club game. I can't see a single justification for it, and I'm amazed that Arsene Wenger is anywhere near it.
Yeah, well, Wenger's basically talking about qualifying matches being played in blocks in October and maybe in the spring, March, groups of four playing six games, top two going through to a summer final. But you've got basically that would just throw a grenade in the middle of the domestic club calendar, wouldn't it, Glenn?
Also, getting more of those sort of mismatches that we saw yesterday. I mean, one of the things that I know it's divided by some, I quite like the Nations Cup. You've got teams playing teams of their level, and that's filled the gap in Europe at least between those qualifying periods, and it also provides a purpose. I mean, Wales are pretty much guaranteed a playoff place because of where they were in the Nations Cup. And yeah, you said he sort of break up the whole sort of season for sort of 6 weeks. I mean, I suppose it gives us, in our country, for example, it would give a bit of boost to non-Premier League football. But it would be, I mean, I can certainly imagine if he was still manager of Arsenal, he would be going mad at this idea.
Yeah, I suppose so. The thing about international football, it does expose, pretty profound issues, doesn't it? We had our own problems in the Euros, which I think we need to acknowledge and probably contextualise in a couple of minutes. But let's dwell on that racist abuse in Hungary. It was unsurprising, given that they were already under sanction. And I know this is probably a naive question, but why didn't FIFA enforce the UEFA ban?
Well, it's a very good question. A ban for a country in international football surely should apply across all jurisdictions and all competitions. I mean, closing their ground for a UEFA competition but leaving it open for a FIFA one is completely nonsensical. Either you've committed the offence or you haven't. So to punish a country in the European Championship and let them carry on as normal in the World Cup makes no sense at all. And it's a classic example of those two bodies not cooperating and creating a problem that could have been avoided, because that stadium should have been closed for the England game, as it would have been had it been a UEFA game. Again, Mike, the context is obviously the punishment that's coming down the line for England for some of their fans invading their own stadium, the booing and the various other problems, shining a light into the eyes of Kasper Schmeichel, the Denmark goalkeeper. The FA has already been punished for that. So England are in big trouble as well in their own way. But the issue of closing grounds when offences like this have been committed is quite straightforward, and it should apply across all competitions.
Yeah, we've been here before, haven't we, Glenn? But why don't teams walk off in those circumstances, or why don't referees stop the game? I think Southgate has been typically fair-minded in pointing out the problems that we face in England, as manifested during the Euros. But this subject just recurs, and it will keep recurring until people like FIFA fulfil promises of what they call adequate action. We know it's not going to be adequate, don't we?
I think in the context of the Hungary game, the players, when they were interviewed immediately afterwards, the ones I saw on the TV, didn't appear to have heard it. So they're focusing on the game. You don't always necessarily hear all the outside stuff. I mean, the people who heard it were reporters and people around behind the goal, like Gabriel Clark, who obviously are more attuned to it and aren't playing in the game. So I think in that case, you can understand, they didn't hear it, so they're not going to walk off. I mean, I guess, and I could also see a temptation in a game like that of the other response is, well, we're really going to sort of humiliate your team. And England clearly wanted to score as many goals as possible, where sometimes you ease up in those games. But England clearly were intent of, not because it's just because the general atmosphere around them and the stuff being thrown at them rather than sort of hearing chants and stuff. Longer term, I think we are looking at a situation where teams have to walk off. But it's not that easy. There is this conflicting thing when you're winning 3-0 away from home you're inclined to want to stay on the pitch and finish the job. It's a bit easier to walk off if you're 2-0 down, or if the game's in the balance. Yeah, as serious as it is, you can see why players are wanting to sort of make their statement on the pitch, because that's what they are, they're players. So it's almost degrees, I suppose, how obvious it is, how much you're hearing it if you're on the pitch. It's extremely difficult for us, having not been in that position, to sort of try and put yourself in that position. So I guess you have to trust the players' own judgments in the circumstances. But whatever decision they make, they should be backed up. I'm confident that Southgate, in particular, and the FA in general, would back up the England team if they did walk off.
Because it's interesting. That's an extension of his sort of broader ethos, I suppose, Paul. The collective personality of the squad that he's created does reflect his management, doesn't it? Inevitably, you know, he made a point of praising them as an incredibly mature, self-supporting group. We have talked about this in the past, but this is a different type of group, isn't it? It's much more natural in public. It's not, doesn't have that sort of, you know, falseness of the media-trained predecessors that we've all dealt with. How important do you think is the sort of philosophical base of this England team?
Well, on that point about them being themselves, I mean, for years people said that if players are encouraged to find their voice and not be afraid of the outside world, not be besieged, if you like, as international footballers, then it would make them better players. And finally, that point has been proved beyond dispute, because all these England players are sort of confident in their own skin. They're not afraid to take a position. They're not afraid to tackle difficult subjects. And I think that has increased their self-esteem, their effectiveness. The classic example is Raheem Sterling, who has said a couple of times now that when he took a stand at Stamford Bridge after he was racially abused playing for Manchester City against Chelsea, that improved him as a player because it enabled him to feel more powerful, more confident about himself, like he had a voice, and that translated into his game, particularly his international game with England. So there is nothing to be gained by suppressing the personalities of footballers. And at the same time, obviously, we live in an age where there are these huge undercurrents, these huge issues, you know, flowing around politically. And the England team and Gareth Southgate have taken on those issues where they're relevant or where it's necessary, you know, and shown themselves to be really modern, intelligent, progressive, kind of grounded people. And this is a very rare thing, not just in England, but I think in any country. And most of us appreciate this change, and we appreciate being able to watch an England team that people can identify with and feel proud of.
Yeah, I thought it was very marked, the warmth towards Bukayo Saka, you know, who's scored England's fourth goal on his 20th birthday. The nature of that squad, Glenn, Paul mentioned Raheem Sterling. Can you just concentrate, please, on two other members? Declan Rice, does he look like captaincy material to you? And someone like Calvin Phillips, there's another relatable player making the most of his chance, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a nice little video that the FA put out last week, didn't they, of Rice presenting the England Player of the Year Award to Phillips, which sort of showed them how natural they were. I do get the feeling within that squad, it's a squad that's very, very supportive of each other, but not in the old siege mentality way that used to be the case in squads that were supporting each other. It's not us against the world, it's us bringing the world with us. What do you think, how well they played in the summer? You know, two players who haven't played in the Champions League, which is seen, you know, rightly as the judge of the landmark, or the benchmark of where you are as a footballer now, and dovetailed expertly together. They will have competition in there for places from Bellingham and Henderson and others, but they do look, they show great maturity. Say Phillips come from a difficult background. He emerged very quickly, still seems very grounded. Rice again, I mean, I know there's lots of talk swirling around him, has been for a couple of years now, about moving, but it doesn't seem to affect his game at all. And the way he's been playing, you know, the start of the season for West Ham this year, the game's been terrific, showing a bit more of himself in the game, the forward aspects of it. Plenty more to come from those two.
Yeah, what about another sign of development, if you like, Paul, is I think England, and specifically Southgate, are getting better at this whole idea of club v country diplomacy. It was notable that Jadon Sancho was released back to United due to what was described as a slight knock, just to ensure his availability for next weekend. And also, you've got players playing the system now, haven't you? Lukaku got a convenient yellow. Ronaldo did the same. Are we getting to the stage of almost like real politics taking over in this, you know, eternal clash between a club and a country?
Well, Gareth Southgate's got so many good young attacking players, he's probably relieved to send a couple of them home every now and again because it gives him less to think about when he's picking his team. But yes, it's definitely becoming more nuanced, that's for sure. I mean, the research I've been doing for my England book shows this to be an issue that goes back, 100 years. You know, it's just been this fascinating kind of scorpion dance between club and country all the way through England's history. It's changed in complexion, obviously, over the years, but it's essentially the same conundrum. It's a fight for the players and a fight for power. And Gareth Southgate has is pretty much on top of that. When you think back to how Sven-Göran Eriksson, for example, was pushed around and allowed himself to be pushed around by Premier League managers, there's no comparison. Southgate's he's a tough character underneath that very genial exterior, and he's not afraid to take a position, but at the same time he's clever. He knows that he has to give and take, and Sancho going back to Manchester United looks like a small example of give and take.
The other thing about it is the players want to play, they want to join up.
That's a big
so
difference.
It makes it much harder for a club manager to say, oh, don't go, you've got a bit of a knock. You know, they're going, no, Gaffer, I want to play, I want to go. I could lose my place in this team.
Yeah, well, I suppose on that theme, Glenn, you've got Gareth Bale, who were without 13 players when they played against Belarus on Sunday for some bizarre reason in Kazan. You know, Gareth Bale is happy now at Real Madrid, he says. Scored a hat-trick for them at the weekend. And he's basically saying, I want to get this team, my country, to a World Cup final. That's just a basic motivation, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, as it happens, the way things have worked out, as I mentioned earlier, they're pretty much guaranteed a playoff place and they're unlikely to get top spot. So in a way, these games are... Yeah, not quite going for the motions, but they're not that. They just need to stay in the top three, really, as far as I understand it. But, I mean, Bale, he's been fantastic for Wales for a long time. It's good to see him back playing some club football, Real Madrid. I mean, fans are pretty forgiving. Someone starts playing well for you. Yeah, there may have been some problems in the past. If Bale starts playing really well for Real Madrid and start looking like he's making a bit of an effort out there and scoring some goals, suddenly you become quite popular again.
Yeah, talking about being popular, a certain Mr. Ronaldo, Cristiano Ronaldo, is going to be a name on most people's lips this week. As I said, he's basically swung the lead, got himself a nice little yellow card by taking his shirt off, so it gives him a week to prepare for the Newcastle game. Paul, you know, well, all of us, we've been around the block long enough to know that the hype's going to be absolutely off the charts. Is it realistic to expect him to make an immediate impact at Man United?
It is, and if he did get that yellow card so that he could prepare for a week, he's obviously assuming already he's going to play a major part in the game. I mean, is Ole Gunnar Solskjaer going to stick him straight in? I suppose he will, but it's an interesting dynamic because I kind of feel I know what I'm going to see from him. You're going to see less mobility, fewer of those 50-yard sprints on counter-attacks that we remember him for in his first incarnation at Man United. It's not the same Ronaldo this time round. But we know we'll see a deadly finisher, we'll see a clever player, cunning player, player of kind of huge, you know, authority and mystique, and he'll do all sorts of good things for Manchester United. But I'm more interested to see what it does to Man United rather than what it does to him, because there are so many questions around that. I mean, will any of Solskjaer's authority be weakened? Will the young players miss out? You know, will this team start revolving around him? Will the whole point of the pattern of play be to get the ball to him? You would hope not. You would hope that Solskjaer will be as strong with Ronaldo in the team as he was before he arrived, because Manchester United are going places a bit jerkily at times, but they are progressing. And I'd like to think that Ronaldo will complement that rather than just kind of turn it into the Cristiano Ronaldo show.
Yeah. Glenn, obviously, you know, you do a lot of work within the women's game. I mean, one of the things about the international break is it has concentrated attention on the start of the WSL season. To a degree, it filled the club void. There were 8,000 or 9,000 at the Emirates yesterday to see Arsenal beat Chelsea. When we're going into this new season, Do you think the women's game is in danger of almost like recreating some of the elitism of the men's game? We saw Manchester City win 4-0 at Everton, who were touted as the best of the rest. What do you feel about the way that the women's game is developing?
I think there's obviously a risk. Yeah, Everton were felt contenders. Suddenly they get beaten 4-0 at home against a City team that got a lot of injuries. So difficult for them. Though they did only have 3 new signings. Everton had played more new signings. And yeah, the back four had been together, though they didn't have Lucy Bronze playing. So it wasn't quite as surprised as it might seem. But it comes down to the same old thing, money. You know, those three clubs have put a lot of money into their teams and they've been rewarded with good, strong sides, with good depth, and it's paying off. But the amount of money we're talking about in the women's game isn't massive. I mean, we're now into millions, but we're not talking about millions and millions. Any team in the Premier League, were they prepared to, could actually invest significantly enough to close that gap quite quickly. And it's interesting, one or two, you know, begin. I mean, Leicester have only just come up. They look quite ambitious. You know, say Everton have made quite a few good new signings. So it's at the moment within the reach of other clubs to challenge what would be regarded as the big clubs in the men's Premier League, to match them in the women's game. I suspect as the sport goes on, that may not necessarily be the case, because you obviously money talks.
Yeah, and it tends to talk fairly loud at Manchester United. You watch them kick off the season, Glenn. Do you feel that they've got a chance of really establishing themselves and almost justifying the, I suppose, strategic support of the women's game within that club, a very belated support?
It's quite hard at the moment to see them break into that top three. I mean, they look a weaker team than last year when they had Heath and Press and Lauren James, all of whom have left. The players coming in, I mean, they've got a new manager in as well. I mean, Casey Stoner was an excellent manager. Mark Skinner's got good experience, but obviously it's a new job for him. So I think having fallen away last year and just missed out on third place, the weakest team last year, Arsenal, have strengthened quite significantly. It's going to be quite hard for them to bridge that gap. You can certainly see themselves consolidate themselves in fourth, but there are only 3 European places in the women's game. And bridging that gap is going to be quite tricky. They need to rely on the top three taking lots of points off each other and not dropping points like they did last year against teams like Reading, who they lost at home to last year. Obviously, this time they beat them.
Yeah, it was interesting, Paul, to listen to Emma Hayes, who I think is a really intriguing, you know, very accomplished coach, talk about the need for the women's game to have parity in almost technological terms, i.e. goal line technology. I thought she should have been a bit more careful about what she wished for when she was going for, say, we need VAR as well. What's your take on all that?
I suppose if you're a leader in women's football as she is, it's natural to want kind of equality in all areas, and technology is one of those kind of almost symbols of progress and development. So I can see why she would want it. She's also seen it work very well, of course, as well as very badly. And so, you know, VAR's kind of public image has improved a little bit, I think, over the summer. But obviously in the English game, we're still capable of making a mess of it. I wouldn't blame her for wanting something in the women's game that is obviously now a very big factor in the men's game, even though it's a factor that a lot of us, quite a lot of the time, regret.
I suppose one of the significant things, Paul, about Emma Hayes and her status at Chelsea is that she is a central member of the senior management team at the club. And with all the implicit support and actual practical support, that means coming from the owner. How important is it that people of, you know, within her orbit at other clubs get the same sort of respect and influence? So that will enable the women's game to almost grow from within.
That's it, exactly, Mike. I mean, it's the progression that women's football has to go on from being kind of, you know, the recipients of you know, male acceptance. So they come into the game and yeah, okay, we'll create a team and we'll let you play on our second pitch, you know, and we'll put a bit of money in, but not too much. You know, from that, those very early days, if you wrote a kind of a line of progression from there to where women's football would need to be, ideally you'd have women in positions of power influencing club politics and club decisions, club policy. And as you said, that's where Emma Hayes is now. And the more women, representatives of women football that are involved at the very top of these clubs, the more women's football is just going to become equal and normalised to the point where it's there's almost no distinction between men and women's football, you know. And you're quite right. Power and influence and positions of authority are vital to that.
Yeah, and in another sense, you know, you had Arsenal, as I said, playing at the Emirates, Glenn. That was a statement win over Chelsea, wasn't it?
It was. Just another point, I mean, Mark Skinner at Manchester United said how welcoming Ole Gunnar Solskjaer had been to him coming in. I think there's quite a lot. I mean, that managers recognise fellow professionals, yeah, within those clubs. The battery's often upstairs rather than across the two sides. But yeah, very impressive win for Arsenal. Again, new manager. Helped by the fact they've had some testing but not too demanding European qualifiers to play, whereas Chelsea have started from scratch, and also helped by the fact that they play more of their big Olympic players from the start, whereas Chelsea are looking to sort of bend them in a bit more slowly. So they had some, you know, top players, Kirby on the bench, whereas Little Miedema started for Arsenal. I mean, Emma made the point afterwards, rather pointedly, she's looking to get her players through the whole season and Arsenal's hadn't had a rest. Well, because with Arsenal in the Champions League qualifiers, they didn't have that as much choice, and they'd probably try and rest them during the season.
Yeah. Let's look at the rest of the international break, if we could, Paul. It's comedic almost, isn't it? It's so surreal, some of the things that have gone on this weekend. When you've got Naby Keita being caught up in a coup attempt in Guinea, and that was just, you know, a subhead to what actually went on in Brazil, where you have health officials invading the pitch to try and deport four English-based Argentine players. What future does international football have given those sort of problems?
Yeah, it's incredible that that issue managed to get that far to the point of sort of officials invading the pitch. It looked highly political, didn't it? They could have stopped that problem way down the line. They didn't have to let it get to the point where the game kicks off and there's mayhem in the stadium. It was political theatre, wasn't it? But at the root of it, there is this problem of players from Europe particularly being sent to or going to red list countries to play international football. And that is clearly problematic and is going to remain so for, well, God, I wish I knew how long, but say for argument, another year. International football is going to have to find a way around this because this current system clearly isn't working. And it's not fair to the players either. Those players who travelled would have faced presumably a serious quarantine when they got back. I can't remember whether they've waived the rules on that for international footballers playing abroad. But, you know, whatever, it's not good for the players. They shouldn't have to be in that position. It's onerous for them. In the short term, South American countries may just have to call fewer players from Europe. I know they won't like that, and it seems unjust. But if the medical constraints on players travelling to red list countries are that serious, where to the point where a Brazil and Argentina game gets called off, you know, a minute into the game, then they can't carry on like this, can they?
Well, it's telling, of course, that the Brazilian players didn't travel, which may be another aspect to the political theatre we saw the other day. I think the Argentine guys the plan was they would quarantine in Croatia on the way back, which means they can sort of, you know, still get exercise and so on. But it's not just football. You know, the problems that rugby's had in the Southern Hemisphere, the Ashes is in doubt because of the situation with COVID in Australia. But international sport is political by definition. I mean, people say keep politics out of sport, but I mean, they play the national anthem before events. It is political.
But you put yourself in the club's position. Let's say, okay, Aston Villa and Spurs did go against the grain in many ways, and they did release key players. And I think they will miss matches because of this. That is unsustainable because the clubs have the power, don't they?
Yeah, and the clubs pay the wages. If you're Dean Smith, you're tearing your hair out. I mean, Martinez had a tremendous impact at Villa. Yeah, and now he's going to be robbed of him for, you know, a couple of weeks. Yeah, and Buendia is one of his, you know, star signings this summer. So this is going to be quite complicated, and it's tough on the players because they're caught in the middle of this.
Yeah, and it's not, Paul, as if people weren't warned. You had the Premier League, La Liga, Ligue 1 in France, Serie A, the European Club Association, who have got another meeting this week about it. They're all saying, just resist this. But FIFA are demanding that players go. I suppose the question is FIFA the problem?
Well, yes, if it's telling players to go to red list countries, which then exposes them in their own countries, their own bubbles. And football has created quite a few successful bubbles, let's face it. If it's sending players out of those bubbles and exposing them to the restrictions that apply to all of us when we're travelling to red list countries, well, that's just not okay. And it is politicking. It's a political gesture to say you will not stop our players playing in FIFA competitions, and there's no regard there, no concern for the players themselves, or indeed the clubs who are within their rights to say, well, we've got a bubble, that works, but if you're asking us to send players to red list countries, that's going to create a level of mayhem that's just not acceptable. But I think your point, Mike, that there is a lack of kind of foresight and cooperation here is the real point, isn't it?
It's a power battle everywhere. Comer Bowl were told by some to use the summer to catch up with the matches that they lost, because they've had quite a lot of matches postponed for COVID already. But they decided they wanted to stage a Copa America instead. I mean, again, it comes down to money, it comes down to power in the federations.
Yeah, but it also comes down to players, Glenn. Basically, you're going to have a burnout problem here, aren't you?
Absolutely. I mean, the players can only play so many matches. Look at Pedri. He basically played all year last year, 18, and thrown straight into a game at the start of the season.
Yeah. I suppose we can wind all this up, really, by looking at almost closer to home and another example of what I suppose I can be charitable and say the clumsiness of the disciplinary system. Paul, what's your thought, or both of you, please, the FA are bringing themselves into disrepute here, aren't they, by charging Middlesbrough's Mark Bowler for a tweet he made when he was a 14-year-old schoolboy? Surely we need a bit of common sense here, don't we?
Well, I think the first principle that needs to apply is that to be applied is that there needs to be an age cutoff. So you can't treat a 14-year-old the way you would treat a 21-year-old. And that there needs to be an age limit, whether it's 16 or 18 or whatever it is, below which you don't go with the full disciplinary force. What you would do with a 14-year-old is if you spotted it, if it was drawn to your attention, you might make a note of it and perhaps have a word with him privately to say, look, you know, we're aware of this tweet thing you said when you were 14. Let's just go through the educational process, but not unleash the full kind of disciplinary tanks on him because he was 14 years old, and that's just not fair to hold somebody account. So to account for that, now when you can argue about the nuances of what you should do and how many tweets or social media posts you should go back to, but the first issue is to create a time, an age limit, a cutoff point before and after which you treat players in a very different, or people in a very different way.
Yeah, it's about context, isn't it, Glenn? And I suppose this also, it does carry the danger that it could undermine the campaign against online hate, which I think we all support and we've all spoken about. They just have to be sensible, don't they?
Yes. I think I agree with Paul. There should be an age amnesty, probably 18. There should probably be a time amnesty as well, 10 years, because the world was in a different place, for better or worse, 10 years ago. There is a slight aspect in that if a 14-year-old, 15-year-old was abusing one of the players who missed the penalties against Italy during the summer, we would be calling for some kind of penalty to be taken. And that, in that respect, they would have been under 18 shouldn't be exempt in those circumstances. So you have to be aware of sort of a double standard in that respect. But I mean, to pull a player up on something that happened 9 years ago when he was 14, and a lot of these things are being picked up when, I mean, in this case, Bowler scored against an opposition team and suddenly this was sent to the FA. So people, and this has happened in newspapers as well, have been trawling through old social media tweets that people tweeted years ago and forgotten completely about and being pulled up. And often, I mean, in this case, the FA was sent it privately, but in other cases, it's gone called to public notice, at which point the FA had to do something, even if it's just to say there is an amnesty, which would get them out of jail in that respect. So it's slightly complicated. A 17-year-old abuses Saka in the summer. Do we say that's fine, he's under 18? We don't, obviously. So you can't necessarily say that all under 18-year-olds have an amnesty. But obviously the time aspects to it, and it's complicated. And it does. I mean, I teach young students, and I say, be very careful what you put on social media, because this stuff is always out there. And, we're a generation that are growing up, we put all their thoughts on social media, as someone might have said in the playground or in the pub to somebody. anyone would have forgotten about a few days later. So it's a case of education, you know, young players. But certainly something 9 years ago for someone's 14, I think that's very much excessive.
Yeah, and it's interesting, but, well, significant, I would have thought, that those charged for social media abuse of England players during the Euros, they range from 18 to 63. So it's not a generational problem. It's a problem stretched across the generations, isn't it?
Yeah, it's the latent bigotry of some people from the older generations that we mixed with at England games. You know, the element, the obnoxious kind of element at England games, and the new, younger kind of social media empowered group who feel that they can say whatever they like. That social media gives them a kind of human right to be abusive about other people. So in that age range from 18 to 63, you've got all those elements, haven't you? Add it all together and you've got a societal problem that just changes but doesn't really go away. But the good news is that we've got a counter reaction among England fans, and we've got an England team and an England manager who've looked it straight in the face and not flinched at all. And that is a very...
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Very powerful thing.
I suppose as a final point, Glenn, does football need to do more to help itself? It's very, very marked that the Premier League, the FA, the EFL have all said we don't need an independent regulator for obvious reasons. Again, we're down to power and money again. We do need an independent regulator, don't we?
Absolutely. I've been going with this for 20 years. Absolutely. I am mildly optimistic that the review that's taken place under Tracy Crouch, who I've got a lot of time for, might produce some change. It rather depends on the political will above her, which I'm less confident about. Certainly, there is a move for change with organisations like Fair Game, some clubs and fans getting involved. But we absolutely need an independent regulator. I mean, it's been obvious for many, many years.
Yeah, well, you do get the impression that the powers that be in the Premier League are delighted that the FA has got responsibility for disciplinary issues. Now, let's face it, no one warms to a traffic warden, do they? As we've said, context is everything. But we've got to ask, where are we heading with this if this Bowler case continues? The FA, what are we going to have next? They sanction a player for a smutty joke he told in the playground or behind the bike shed when he was 6 or a primary school? This case is ludicrous and it should be quietly dropped. It's detracting attention from genuine abuse and real victims. Do you agree? Please let me know. In the meantime, Thanks to Paul and Glenn for their insight. And thank you for listening to the Football Writers Podcast.